Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Are in the interview part of the show, and joining us today is a Canadian author. And the book we're going to be talking about is The Trials of Albert Strobel. And it's Love, Murder, Justice, and the End of the Frontier. And that's Chad Reimer. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So, Chad, let's first of all, now, is this your first book that you've written?
No. It's fourth that I've published. So,
wow.
Okay. My previous one, which came out about a year ago, was on a lake that was drained in the 1920s. It was a more historical book called, Before We Lost the Lake, and how Sumas Lake had been this major feature in between in the Fraser Valley. So.
Wow. Oh, what made you get into this book? Like, this is a true crime book, right? So this is more a little bit more different than just your typical history. How did you find this case, and what got you into it?
Yeah, I became aware of it when I was researching the history of Sumas Lake and Sumas Valley, and I came across as I'm going through the newspapers, researching how people were using the lake and so forth, I came across this coverage of the trial of Albert Strobel, which went on for quite a while, and I thought, wow, this is quite an event. Maybe I can get a little article out of it somehow. And so I bookmarked, as it were, those newspaper reports, and then when I finished work on the Sumas Lake book, I came back to this, and I realized that, I wanted to look into it more, found a lot of records on it at the archives in Victoria, and also some records because Strobel was American, and he lived in BC for a bit, and then he's back in the States, and so I found out more information in the archives down in Washington State, and it just all came together. It was just a fascinating story. And still I thought, hey, this will be part of a larger book that I'm doing. But then it grew into a book itself. So it is a departure. I mean, I'm a trained historian. I've got a PhD in history, and I taught history for quite a while. And so, I mean, I still think of myself as a historian, but I like reading true crime and mostly historical true crime, and also mystery novels with a historical setting. So this one let me kind of stretch my legs a bit.
How did you find it? But when you do something like this, took place wherein it was in 1893. So when you're researching something that long ago, how much work does that take? That must take quite a bit of effort to find all these records.
Yeah. I mean, for a book like this, it would be about a year of the research and then a year of putting it together and writing it. And that's full time. I've been able to work it out so that I can work on this full time. So it is a lot of research. It doesn't feel like work because I love doing it so much. But it is important for me. It's like I want to get everything that is available on such a topic, and you know, and then sit down and try to sift through and make a good story out of it. So, I haven't decided which I enjoy more, whether it's the research or the writing. The writing's harder, but when it's going, I certainly enjoy it. But I do enjoy the research.
It's pretty interesting finding out things, you know, in the past, mm-hmm. and researching. That's always good. Now, what is the premise of the story? We're talking about someone that was murdered. Let's talk about the actual murder and the case. What do we know about that?
Well, his body, the victim was a fellow known as John Marshall. That's what he put down on his legal documents. He was from the Azores Islands, off the coast of Portugal. He came to the States in the 1850s or 60s, and then came up north and ended up in British Columbia in the 1880s. He was making a go of farming. He had 160 acres just north of the border where Sumas City in Washington is, and now on your way to where Abbotsford is in British Columbia. And he was making a go of it farming, and his body was found on his veranda in February, in the spring of 1893, and he had been shot twice, and an investigation followed and so forth, and Albert Strobel was arrested for it, and then he went to trial, and things followed after that, and then in the trial and the information started to come out, of course, as to what might have happened, what did happen, and all the interesting stuff behind it.
So when someone is found like that, that's dead, and especially in a farm place, and this is in 1890s, how much policing was there, and how good were they?
There was no policing. There were no policemen outside of New Westminster. So this is about 30 miles away, I guess, 20, 30 miles away.
Yeah.
And what happened was they had to telegraph. So a neighboring farmer who was an American trapper who had just been temporarily staying in the area, he came across the body. He ran down to the railway station 2 miles away. And at the railway station, they telegraphed the police in New Westminster, and the policeman, a fellow by the name of William Moresby, who he was an acting policeman. His first job was actually warden of the provincial jail. He and the coroner, who wasn't a policeman either, headed out. And so the body was found at about 5:30 or so in the morning, and it took until 2 in the afternoon for the police to actually arrive. And Moresby had to deputize. He had the power to deputize special constables, so he did that. And then he also enlisted the help of David Lucas, who was the part-time marshal of Sumas City on the American side. And so it was, you know, Moresby was the only one with experience, the only official with experience as a policeman. Lucas had experience as a policeman too, but he was American. He had no authority. So there was not police presence on the ground at the time, and certainly their ability to mount an investigation was, very, very crude. They didn't isolate the crime scene, of course. By the time Moresby got to where the body was, it was left where it was killed, where it hadn't been moved inside. But there were perhaps 20, 30 people traipsing all over John Marshall's homestead, his home and his yard and everything. So it was, it got off to a poor start, pretty much every other murder investigation would have at the time outside of New Westminster and Victoria, where they had, full-time police officers.
Yeah, but pretty interesting. But now it only took them 2 days to arrest Albert Strobel. So why was the arrest so fast? Like, what was it that made him the suspect?
His own moves. I mean, when I'm thinking back and thinking, at how poor the policing was and so forth, I think, it's a wonder that they find the murderer at all. But then it's also a flip side where there are so few people there, and everybody knows who everybody is, that in a certain way it's harder to hide. Because if you did do something suspicious, somebody will notice. Or if you're in the area and a new person in the area, someone will notice. It's kind of, flip side to it. But the reason why Strobel was arrested within 2 days, he was suspected right from the start, because people were coming forward and saying, he was seen the afternoon before. He was perhaps one of the last to see John Marshall alive. And he had been, he actually was helping Marshall during the previous day. And then he came out into the field to do some work, and he did some work with another neighbor. And he was hot, so he took off his jacket, threw it aside, and then took out his revolver and threw it onto his jacket. And this was in full sight of the fellow who's working beside him. So when Marshall was found shot the next day, his neighbor immediately suspected Strobel and told the police, the police when they came in that, I think it's him. And really, they didn't, the investigation involved trying to find proof that Strobel did it. That was the investigation. Mm. So it was tunnel vision from the very start.
Yeah, they had their mind on it. But now, it says that Strobel was, he was 20 years old, but he was physically disabled and short. So what kind of disability did he have?
It wasn't diagnosed, of course. Probably didn't even, might never even have seen a doctor, but his right leg was permanently, it was kind of locked the knee was locked in a bent position, and his foot was twisted inward. So he had been told he had inflammation of the bone. So it would have been some form. It might even have been an injury, broken leg when he was younger, although he never mentioned it. Broken leg that was not fixed, or it could have been some sort of arthritic or bone disease that had done it. But it sounds as if he'd had it for a while, and he had adjusted to that. He used a cane to walk, and so. He was already short. They measured him up at 5'4", and then when he would be having to bend down, of course, he would be even shorter while he was walking.
Hmm. So, like, what did the community think? Like, so when he got arrested 2 days later, was everybody in shock, or were they think, oh, he's not a good guy? Or, like, what was the atmosphere?
It was divided. He was thought of as a good boy. Everyone said he was a good boy, and it was always boy. It was never a man. Of course, in that time, if you're 20, 21 years old, you're a man.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But he was thought of as a boy, and it's partly because of his disability, and partly because of he was just, you know, developmentally was not the sharpest tool in the shed. Emotionally, he didn't seem to get things that other people did. So people, by and large, he was, you know, a well-meaning, harmless, you know, fellow. He was willing to help people out without getting paid. He would go over to Marshall's place and clean it up and go out help in the field and without getting paid. And so he was thought of as a harmless character. And so the news, yes, it came as a shock to most people, although most of them also had heard the evidence of him being seen with a revolver and that. So it was a shock to what they had thought of him, you know, what he was capable of before. But it wasn't a shock when they started hearing all this circumstantial evidence against him. But still, it was, you know, even through his two trials, public opinion was split over whether he was guilty or not. So
now was he an American, Marshall?
Marshall was Portuguese, right? Strobel was American.
Okay,
John Marshall.
Was it like an Americans on the Bellingham, that side, were pro him, like he didn't do it, and the Canadians thought he did? Like, was it split with the country?
No.
Okay.
There, in a lot of ways, the border didn't exist in the minds of the people who lived. You know, it's Sumas Prairie to the, you know, north of the line, B.C., and then south of the line. It's one of the few areas in BC that is just flat, and so geographically there's no split. The people.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare tri-term medical plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
You know, a good half of the number of people living north of the line were Americans, and they had just come there not that many years before. And the only shops in town were in Sumas City on the south side. And so everybody on, you know, from the BC side, not if they needed to see a doctor or go to the grocery store or whatever, they just went across the line. The line didn't really exist. And so there wasn't this, you know, Americans rallying around an American and the Canadians thinking, you know, oh, it's a violent American that came in and did some killing. It wasn't that at all. So it just split upon, you know, what the people were willing to think of this guy that they used to think of as this harmless.
Trials here in Canada, typically, especially a murder trial, sometimes can take up to 2 to 3 years before it goes to trial. Now, mm-hmm. I know this guy was tried quite quickly. Can you talk about that and what you learned?
Well, actually, for the time, his trial was, his second trial came quickly after the first. That would not have happened. But his first trial, the murder was in the spring, in April, and his trial didn't open up until November. And the reason why is that the courts held 2 sittings a year for criminal trials, serious criminal trials. One in the spring, April, May kind of thing, and one in the one in the spring, which is late May and June, and one in the fall, which was November. The trial was supposed to, it was put up onto the spring docket, and it would have been heard on the spring docket, but the Crown asked that it be postponed. Because the policeman in the case, William Morrisby, was ill. So it could have been heard just like weeks after, and some of the murder trials were heard just weeks after they occurred. It all depended where at what point. And the courts only sat for a couple of weeks. So then the trial was put back to November. So from April through November, he had to wait in prison for the trial, because bail isn't granted for murder. And the first trial was a long trial by the time, but, you know, over almost 2 weeks. And then that ended in an even split, 6-6 in the jury. And then because, you know, the judge was convinced that he was guilty. He told the jury that the defendant was guilty, but the jury was split, and the Crown then asked, well, can we move the trial and have it done in Victoria? And we could do that within a week or two, because Victoria was still sitting with its trials. And so within 2 weeks, it moved from New Westminster to Victoria. So that was very quick, you know, after the first trial. It was very quick that a second trial was granted. So
what happened now? What kind of evidence did they have against him?
The evidence that was presented was his revolver. It was a cheap five bullet revolver that he had gotten off a friend, and he actually had all of the evidence that was seized on the American side of the border by this fellow, David Lucas, who was a character straight out of, you know, central casting in Hollywood. It's, you know, if you wanted a whiskey-drinking, tobacco-chewing lawman, he was your man. He actually was the younger brother of this fellow who founded one of the first private detective agencies along the coast. He learned all the tricks in the book, how to plant evidence and so forth. So all of the evidence that was obtained by him in the United States and then just taken across the line and given to the Canadians. So all the evidence would have been thrown out in courts nowadays. Strobel had voluntarily given his revolver to Lucas, because Lucas fooled him into doing that. Lucas found a couple of loaded cartridges in Strobel's room, and then conveniently, 3-4 days after the murder, found some spent cartridges just outside Strobel's window. Lucas grabbed his revolver. Strobel into giving him his revolver. He found a couple of cartridges, live ones, in Strobel's room. He found a couple of empty cartridges outside of Lucas's window, although it's very dodgy how they could be so clean and obviously right in the open after so many days. And then, of course, there was the evidence he'd been seen beforehand. He'd been seen on the walking around Marshall's place at certain times. And so that was largely the evidence. It was interesting because it was probably the first case where the conviction rested upon the ability to, or at least to convince the jury, that a slug that came from the victim, that had killed him, came out of the gun, was matched to the gun that was possessed by the defendant. And so that kind of ballistics matching, specifically one slug to one gun, had never been done in Canada. And this was one of the first times. And this was in an age, nobody was aware of the fact that, people were aware of the fact that when a bullet travels through a rifled barrel, that, marks are made, which of course we know now. But they didn't know until the 1920s, work done by an American, that every bullet fired has markings that were unique to a barrel. Each barrels are like fingerprints, right? So they were 40 years away from that realization. But what they used was what gunsmiths would get up and say, well, the marks on this bullet were made by the rust in the barrel, and I shot another round into a barrel of cotton, and the marks that are on that round that I shot are similar, and they're both made by this rust that is on the barrel, in the barrel. And that's how this That's the match that the jury was convinced of in this case.
Hmm. So, and now, so we jump to the second trial in Victoria. Now, they found him guilty on that one, didn't they?
They did, yes.
So, so he was sentenced to death. So did they end up killing him over this crime?
should I say spoiler alert?
Oh. Okay, well,
what I'm really fascinated with is you know, after his conviction, the story isn't over. You know, there's still a lot more drama involved, he actually Strobel has been saying from November to December that he's completely innocent. He wasn't there. He had gone fishing, and his defenders had been saying yes, you know, they were convinced of that. And after the conviction, there was a bit of a groundswell, people who were still convinced of his innocence, and they started petitioning the federal government to make sure, oh no, you know, we can't have him executed because the evidence just wasn't quite there. Of course, the other side said he was guilty. But he does a series of confessions, each one a little different from the one before, and essentially ends up saying that it was self-defense, that Marshall had attacked him. He was in his house, and Marshall had attacked him, and they had been talking about this girl, the name of Elizabeth Bennett. Elizabeth. Oh boy, Bartlett. Me and names don't go well together. That he Strobel and she were unofficially or officially engaged, and he comes in his confession. He says that Marshall made bad comments about her. They got to fighting, and he shot him in self-defense. And Strobel makes this confession a number of times to different people, even though his lawyer is going having a fit trying to make him stop. And you're still wondering, okay, well, is this going to be enough to get him off the death sentence, at least? He certainly thinks it will. So, it goes into this package. Every execution at the time had to be approved by the federal cabinet and the governor general. And the only decision that had to be made was to either execute or have a life sentence. And so Strobel's only hope was to get a life sentence. And that's what he hoped his confession, you know, explaining how it all happened. That's what he was banking on in terms of trying to save his life. So,
right.
Yeah.
So when, at the end of the story, like when you wrote this book and finished it, so when people read it, what is it that you want them to take away from reading the book?
I want them to. First and foremost, I want them to buy the book and read it. And
yeah, of course.
I want them to get the enjoyment out of reading about another period of time when things were done differently, and about reading the human stories, you know, that people you read about in history were real people. They were, you know, we could have been walking through that time if we'd been born earlier. So, I want people to make that kind of connection to that, you know, that these are real breathing people, and they might do stupid things just like we do. There aren't necessarily good guys and bad guys, although, you know, there sometimes are good guys and bad guys. So I guess what I want people, I, it's kind of, you know, it's escapism in the sense of taking us out of our here and now and connecting us to another time and things done differently, and doing it through a story that has a bit of suspense in it. So I guess that's it. Mm. I mean, you know, entertaining, yeah. And you learn, if you learn a bit, that's great. So
yeah. Oh, so now, do you have a website or a site for the book or for yourself that people can come find you or find out more about the books you've done? Or do you just are in social media?
No. I'm not on social media. The book itself, more information on it, people can Google Caitlin Press, C-A-I-T-L-I-N, Press, and they have a bit more on there. There is a podcast available done by Selba out in Ontario, a podcast called Real Murder, and that was an hour and a bit with me talking about it. Caitlin Press, actually, she just put out, she's trying to, you know, in this, with the coronavirus and everything, I can't go do readings, I can't and do book launches and such, so we've had to be creative in terms of getting information about the book out. So at their website, at Caitlin Press, there's a couple of minute book trailer where it kind of rolls through pictures as it's enticing you to read it. They have asked me to put up a 2 or 3 minute, me talking and videoing an introduction to the book.
Well, that's okay.
Yeah.
What we'll do is we'll put the book up on our site. We'll have it so people that are listening can just click on it and pick up the book anytime. And hopefully things get better with the coronavirus and everything, and you can get out and do some readings and writings and signings,
exactly.
And whatever else.
For access as well, it is on Amazon, both in the States,
right,
and Canada. Barnes & Noble, I believe, as well, in the States, and Chapters in Indigo in Canada, and then a number of other book-selling sites as well. So,
fantastic.
It is.
It all helps,
yeah.
So now the book we're talking about is The Trials of Albert Strobel, and it's Love, Murder, and Justice at the End of the Frontier, and our guest is the author, Chad Reimer. Thank you for being here, Chad.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Chad.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end! By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll tell you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.